Welcome to the MatchFit USA Soccer Show. I'm Jason Davis. Thank you for joining me this week. Thanks to some smoke and mirrors, the magic of the internet, and the goodness of friends, MatchFit USA is finally back for your listening enjoyment. I know all of you missed the show desperately, and I certainly wouldn't want to deprive you any longer. This week on the show, we'll discuss MLS Commissioner Don Garber's comments on the American soccer consumer, his ridiculous tiff with the president of the New York Yankees, the state of officiating in Major League Soccer, perhaps a little bit about some American youngsters, and some developments on the U.S. World Cup bid front. The magic of the internet not only makes this show possible, it also makes it possible to have great guests. And this week we have two of the best. First, the host of the Winning Ugly radio show and therefore the greatest straight man working in comedy soccer broadcasting today, Mr. Scott Bornstein. Hi, Scott.
Flattery will get you everywhere. You now have 3 bonus points when you show up on the show. Thank you, Jason. It has nothing to do with the fact that I have the equipment to actually put your show up right now. Thank you.
Also with us, an esteemed panelist from the aforementioned Winning Ugly radio show, proprietor of Ginge Talks the Footy, Ginge himself, Mr. Zach Woosley. Hi, Zach.
Hello, Jason. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you for the straight response. I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, you know, Scott will be the comedy. I'll be the straight man.
It's a little role reversal.
Exactly.
Well, no, Scott's funny. I don't want to take anything away from Scott's comedy skills.
Thank you. I don't usually get to speak much, so this is a change for me.
Well, hopefully you'll fill my show with lots of good content.
I've got to be better than Hank.
Possibly. Possibly. And I don't give points, but I would if I could. All right, boys, let's get right into it. The first thing I wanted to talk about this week, a lot has been made recently about some things that Don Garber has said to the media. And the first one was this story on the Goal blog at New York Times, a story by Jeffrey Marcus, where Garber basically indicated that maybe MLS isn't getting to soccer fans quite the way they should, and that perhaps the league needs to make some changes. I don't know that he directly indicated there would be changes, but he certainly made it sound like MLS isn't doing the best job marketing themselves to the established American soccer fan. What do you guys think of that, Scott?
I read the article, and I looked at what he said, and I think it's kind of – he's talking about – you know, the increase in the game. I think the most important thing that he spoke about is that he felt like this expansion happened 10 years faster than he projected, with the increase in people in America able to watch the game on the internet. And
people got smarter faster than
they thought. Yeah, and with that, you know, he's kind of like, you know, our fans are more educated, which was kind of almost a shot at himself in the league, which I actually appreciated, which was the fans have become more educated than our game has developed in the same time frame. And to be able to stay competitive with other leagues or to bring people in, maybe I need to go and allow them to go outside more of the country and bring more in. I think it was a great comment from him.
So you give him credit for what he said.
Very much so.
The question, though, is if he thinks this happened 10 years before he expected it to, does that maybe mean he was a little naive?
I would agree with that. I would think he was a little short-sighted in what he thought the growth of the game could be globally. He was probably more focused on where he thought the growth of the game was going to happen when they started just here in America. And as our league has done, it forgets that it's part of this huge global game. And as the world expanded and the global game has continued to expand, that affects what's happening here in the States, because you have all of these people who are watching those other leagues but not yet interested in our league, in the MLS, in their domestic league, because it's just not growing at the same pace.
All right. Well, Zach, anything that you took away from Garber's comments and what kind of changes? He's not, like I said, I'm not sure he directly said anything. He may be alluding to them. What kind of changes do you think need to happen to get all these fans that are into European soccer and leagues around the world, but not necessarily MLS?
Well, I think the first thing important to realize is that before I ever got into doing the Winning Ugly show or the other shows and doing my blog, I was, and Scott can attest to this, I was one of the biggest enemies, so to speak, of Don Garber. I thought he was doing things wrong. I didn't like the direction things were going. And the last year or so, I've changed my opinion. I absolutely love what he has said in this article. I think he's getting it. I think the league is starting to get the things that they need to do to be competitive and to draw in fans. I mean, we have to give him a little bit of leeway in the sense that no one has ever been able to form a soccer league in the United States and make it last. And right. So far, they're doing that. You know, we've survived. This is, what, the 14th season? Right. So things are working. But changes have to be made. You have to be fluid. And I think Garber is starting to see that and realizes that you can't stay status quo. The things that may have worked when they first started the league, the things that may have worked 5 years ago aren't necessarily what is going to work now. And as long as they are able to react to those and to be able to be open to the idea that things may need to change or things need to go a different direction, then I think they're going to be successful. Now, as far as drawing in fans of the European game, fans of the English game, what Don basically said in the article where, you know, fans want to see stars, fans want to see more games on TV, they want to increase quality of play. The key is the quality of play. I mean, the MLS quality of play isn't as bad as a lot of people pick on it for, and as I've been guilty in the past for
creating. Right, but every now and then something pops up, and take, this is a perfect example. Thursday night, Kansas City and New York are on ESPN. That's the national audience. It's the biggest audience that MLS can get. And that's a stinker of a game.
Yeah, but you know what? I've tuned into plenty of English or Spanish games that should be a huge game, and it's a stinker. It happens. I mean, there's nothing the league can do about that.
What do you mean, like that's every Chelsea-Liverpool game? Like 9 out of 10 Chelsea-Liverpool games that are supposed to be the big ones? Yeah.
Right, but the problem is that those leagues can fall back on their history and the romance of it and the fact that it's England. And the MLS doesn't have those luxuries or imperative. They have to go above and beyond just a little bit better just so that it looks – I mean, it's a sliding scale.
They need to realize – and we have to remember that fans of the game who have followed soccer for a while are realize that sometimes games are going to be a stinker. Now, obviously, if you have people who have never tuned into it before or newer and that's the only exposure they've had to the game, then something like that, you're right, could be have a derogatory effect. But I think that's the least of what the league can – worry about it. It's not like the teams intentionally went out there and sandbagged or something. You know, it was somewhat a legitimate red card call. I mean, it's one I think the ref had to make. And you know, not every game is going to be perfect. So I don't think that's really anything.
No, it's unfortunate about. More than anything else. I'm not saying that it. You know, MLS could do anything about it. It's just that's the way that game played out. And for 85 minutes. It was painful to watch. So there, you know, that's like I said, that's just an unfortunate situation for the league. Now, with all of the good things that Garber has said and all of the credit we're giving him here for seeming to get it, what can he really do? I mean, the league is handcuffed by their financial situation because it's still a growing league. There's not a lot of money coming in. What kind of changes are even possible?
We need more exposure for people like Winning Ugly Radio, Matchfit USA. Part of what's missing from the game, and I'm sorry, I'm just jumping in and shameless self-promoting that, but the point still being, there's not still enough drama tied to the game. There's not enough, when we're talking about marketing, because that's one of the things we're talking about, it's not marketed well enough. There's no culture, but there is a subculture that is beginning to form. And how do we, as people who are trying to be part of that, get that out there to increase the excitement of the games, to increase the need to be in desired games? I watched 6 games yesterday that were just outstanding. And because I understand the games and I understand their meanings, I loved it. But if I was a casual fan and I watched, you know, the Colorado-LA game yesterday, I would shoot myself in the head and never go and watch another game again.
Well, that's an education issue.
But the education level here is – it depends. If your soccer education or your football education is all European, you're not going to be concerned about this league here. But someone like me who kind of – found the game both at the same time. I appreciate my own league. I go and I follow it and I support it because I love it and I've made myself tied into it. It's how does Garber promote people being tied in with the league and the meaning of what this game is in the scope of here and our culture?
Well, I think what his point was is that there's a lot, you know, the issue isn't getting casual sports fans that don't already care about soccer. He made his direct quote was, soccer doesn't live in the consciousness of the typical sports fan. That's okay. I mean, that's good self-awareness on his part for the fact that MLS isn't going to just jump into the American sports scene and become a big deal. It's going to take some time for that to happen. But for the time being, it's about getting millions and millions of American sports soccer fans, football fans, who ignore MLS. Zach, I mean, what do you think that – what kind of draw is there for – an American whose favorite team is Liverpool, who pays attention to the EPL and never even looks at MLS, how does the league get those people?
Well, I think you need to, like Scott said, it's a lot of it's marketing. There's such an inconsistent marketing plan with the league, with each team does. You have to be ambitious. I mean, you have to realize that it's going to be a challenge to reach out and grab those fans. I mean, I was a fan of the game and the European game before MLS started. And I didn't even start paying attention to MLS till season 12. And I knew it was there. but I ignored it. And, you know, I'm guilty of that, of not supporting the American League because I just didn't care. And when I tuned in, I didn't like it. And I allowed a lot of those, my tunnel vision to kick in and affect that. And now I've gotten over that a bit, and it's all the better for it. But to get those fans, I think you just need to be, you need to keep working on the product on the field. You need to be consistent, and you need to make sure that you're plugging into that sort of underground movement, so to speak, that is building. I mean, a big problem with people's perception of MLS and soccer in America is because they get their information from a limited amount of sources, such like ESPN or the main major, quote unquote, major media, and the quality of reporting and the attention they give to the sport is really not very good. And I think in a lot of ways, ESPN, despite being the biggest market for the MLS getting its game out to a national audience, does a lot of damage to the league. I don't think they take the broadcasting of the game seriously. I don't think they do as well with it. I mean, I know it's not the moneymaker advertising wise that like an NFL match is or whatever else, but you know, at the same time, you feel like from a broadcasting perspective that every sport deserves the same attention and equal opportunity. That said, you know, there's a ton of people out there like us, and I'm not trying to just, you know, to sell what we do, but there's a ton of people out there that write and podcast and broadcast otherwise that genuinely care about the MLS game and want the MLS game to succeed. And I think a big step forward for the MLS to help affect soccer fans is to reach out to the people like us, to the writers, to the bloggers, to the people that are trying to push the game, because a lot of us can speak to the fans that maybe don't want to pay attention, that maybe don't take it seriously. And if a lot of us start trumpeting good things about the MLS, then there's a better chance that people may give it a shot, because they figure, well, I like what so-and-so says or what so-and-so writes. Maybe I should give it a chance. Maybe I should listen to what they're saying. And I think there's maybe an opportunity there for the league to go beyond just reaching out to those major media outlets and take advantage of the people that are out there busting their hump to write about the league and to write about the game.
The league should definitely think outside the box on that. Now, you mentioned the mainstream media and their coverage of MLS and soccer in general, but specifically MLS, because it doesn't have the cultural resonance that other sports have. And it was funny because this week Don Garber kind of made headlines for MLS that normally don't happen, because he made some comments about the New York Yankees and their struggles to sell tickets in their new stadium. And the president of the Yankees shot back at Garber and kind of turned it into this little feud. Now, I think Garber's comments were completely taken out of context by Randy Levine, the Yankees president. Do you see this as a good step forward for the league because they've gotten this kind of mainstream media attention? Or is this just another issue, another situation where soccer bashers can come out of the woodwork and do more damage than the media attention will actually help? Scott?
I think it's going to depend on what happens next. I did see what happened, and it's tough where he's like, you know, he almost came out to the point where saying, listen, my payroll is bigger than your entire league.
Oh, no, he's turned like, into a giant pissing match. I mean, that's what it is.
And it's ridiculous because when you really, to your point, I mean, listen, I've been watching the games. Garber wasn't lying. Those seats are empty behind home plate. But part of the reason is they're $50,000 for probably a half season for one seat.
Right.
It's a completely different scenario. You're talking about a stadium. I mean, they were talking about get your league in shape and you know, maybe come talk to us when you're at that point. Well, the MLS hasn't just picked up $1.8 billion in debt just because they built one stadium at this point. I think it's – I don't know if it's good for the two of them to be fighting, because I don't think it's a fight that the MLS can win. But I think it's a good starting point for conversation where if Garber can handle this scenario correctly – and come out and maybe make light of what he's talking about, or use it to talk up his league and the positive things that are happening in his league versus the Yankees that are going on right now, maybe some good spin will come out of it. But your initial reaction is basically it's the little 4'3" kid getting pounded on by some 6-foot bully.
There is an issue. There is an opportunity for Garber to point to the to look at the price point and make it clear that, you know, obviously – what he's doing and the league that he's promoting, it's not the New York Yankees. Everybody knows that. The Yankees are, you know, the biggest brand in American sports. I mean, that's just a fact. And I think it's funny that, I mean, you could look at it two ways. Did Levine lower himself into this pissing match with Garber, or did MLS kind of raise their profile by the fact that Levine's even paying attention to what Carver said?
I'd like to see right now, I'd like to see him put Seattle up against, say, the Pittsburgh Pirates. I bet that would make a good argument.
Well, Levine doesn't have anything to do with the Pirates.
No, I know that, but I'm just saying, like, he's talking about how the Yankees, it's like, but at the same time, you know, there is a success story in his league, so he should be using this to talk up the Sounders right now.
Zach, what should he say?
You guys got this all wrong. Look, this is fantastic. This is great. Because, look, this forces people to talk about MLS, talk about soccer. And when you go, whether or not, I don't think Garver intended this to happen, but it's happened. So you might as well roll with it. I mean, look, everybody knows Randy Levine's an idiot. The guy's an absolute moron. Even Yankee fans.
I was going to say, I'm a Yankee fan, and I can't deny that statement.
Yeah, I mean, nobody likes this guy. So Levine had no business saying anything or reacting to this. So the fact that he did, he drew himself into this. So the MLS can take advantage of it. And here's why I really think it's fantastic, is because the SoccerNet article about this, there's 802 comments on that article. And you know what? I haven't read all of them. I don't have that much free time. But you know what? There's a lot of pro soccer comments that I've seen in that list. And you know what excites me? Is that compared to baseball fans, soccer fans are loud. We're a bit obnoxious at times.
Well,
and
you are talking about Yankee fans. The loudest, most obnoxious.
Yes, but I firmly believe that as soccer fans, we can outshout Yankee fans. As a movement, we can be much louder and much more audible than a Yankee fan. So, look, I think this is one of the connects back to what we said before. MLS, they shouldn't touch this. Garber shouldn't say anything about it, but, you know, if you had a network built with the bloggers and the people out there who can say things that MLS can't get away with, this is when you turn to them and you have a mass sort of underground email that says, you guys want to go after this, and you unleash people on it. Because you could go out and we could do a lot of damage and make a lot of noise about this. And I think it's a potentially a really positive thing for the league to run, if we could run with it and go with it, because, you know, the Yankees are in a bad spot. They have no ground to stand on. I mean, and it just makes them look dumb for going after a lower level sport. I mean, it's exactly like you guys said, it's the bully picking on the little kid. And
yeah, I think unfortunately that there's a bit of on the part of MLS, and I don't know about Garber personally, but I think on the part of MLS there's this, we don't want to mess with the big boys kind of attitude that says that they don't go after these other sports. Like, they're all in it together, even though they're not. And I don't know that MLS views themselves as competing with Major League Baseball or with the Yankees in New York or anything like that. But for some reason, there's this, I don't really get why we don't have the leaders of MLS or ownership or anything like that going after some of these ridiculous situations like the Yankees have with their their pricing issues and their stadium being completely, you know, ridiculously overpriced for any of the average fans.
Try getting a ticket to the Cowboys game down here now. Don't even
That's the thing. I think MLS is better suited to deal with whatever economic situations going on because of those issues. But okay, let's go ahead and take our first break. Zach Boosley, Scott Morenstein with MatchFit USA Soccer Show. Be right back. Welcome back, MatchFit USA Soccer Show. Jason Deeps with you. I also have my guests, Zach Boosley and Scott Morenstein. Just got done talking a lot about Don Garber. And there were some good things in there, some things that Garber's done to make himself and the league look better. Now, there are some other issues going on around MLS that have some people concerned, and specifically I'm talking about officiating. There's a lot of noise being made, and we mentioned the Thursday night match, KC and New York, and that red card that came out in the first 5 minutes of that game. I'm not sure exactly when it happened, but it was awfully quick. People are talking about MLS officiating being so bad that it's ruining the game. Do either of you guys, Zach, I'll start with you. Do either one of you guys see any ways to fix it? Do you think there's a problem first? And do you see any ways to fix it?
Yeah, there's a big problem. I mean, MLS officiating is inconsistent, and it's not, you'll have games where it's good and you'll have games where it's just plain awful. You want to fix it? The league needs to take control of their officials. Now, granted, I didn't do enough research and I'm not sure as far as how the FA-EPL relationship is in England, but it just seems like, from an MLS standpoint, if you realize how much criticism your officials get, how much issues where they seem to have way too much influence over a match. And I know that happens in all football, but we're talking about the MLS, so we have to focus on that idea that there's officials that just don't seem to make the right decisions in the right situations. I mean, to the point where they destroy the integrity of the match, in my opinion, and destroy the flow of the match. And that's bad. And, you know, if the MLS is going to take a step forward, you've got to find a way to broaden your officials pool and find guys that on a consistent basis are going to do a better job. I mean, I don't know if they need to set up a better grading system for these officials. So I think the MLS needs to hold these officials more accountable. If a guy does something that is just an obvious bad call and obviously detrimental to the match, you know, you can't put him out the next week and say, oh, don't worry about it, go do another one. You know, you've got to adjust, because it may not be a problem now, but we talked about in the previous segment with grabbing the attention of those European fans, grabbing attention of people that aren't taking the MLS seriously. If you finally tune into a match and you see a horrific red card call, or you see a decision by a referee that changes the game, that's going to quickly make a flash decision in your mind. Oh, well, that's Mickey Mouse or whatever you want to call it. And that's not a good thing for the game at all.
Scott, any thoughts on the MLS officiating situation?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things we have to take into account, and some of them are tied in actually to the previous conversation, which is part of the conversation that Garber was talking about is how the league has expanded and the fans' knowledge has expanded, but the American player has not expanded as quick as everyone else. Well, think about the status of American referees, where they probably have had no advancement whatsoever in 15 years since the league's been around. So we can't expect perfect refereeing, but the solution may be, I believe, I don't know if it's just in England with the FA, but I believe there's a retirement age of somewhere around 45 for their referees, like they have to be done at that point. Our game isn't as fast as the English game. Maybe we need to start looking at you look at someone like Graham Pohl, who would be amazing to come over and work with our referees. I think that you need to start looking outside of the U.S. to see how we can start developing and bringing referees over and then retraining the ones that we have to be maybe a little bit more, I'm trying to figure out the word that I want to be, consistent, because I think to Zach's point really is, the fact is the inconsistency that drives us nuts, is we can watch the same referee crew call two games and nowhere near any sort of consistency in how they call it, which also makes it difficult on the players, because when you're talking about how you want the league to succeed, if the players don't have an idea of how the referee's going to call a game, then they have to constantly be trying to adjust their game to fit that referee however he feels that week. And I think that's detrimental to the game.
To your point about bringing in outside, you mentioned Graham Pohl bringing in, maybe foreign referees to help raise the level. You think U.S. soccer is being stubborn in that regard?
I can't say that I'm knowledgeable in that answer. I wish I knew if they're being stubborn or not. I just haven't heard of it happening. So I'm just throwing out the idea, not 100% knowing if it's something they have looked into. So I'm kind of uneducated in it.
I wanted to sound smart,
Jason, and you completely ruined it for me.
No. You sounded fine, Scott. Don't worry about it. I don't know either. I mean, that's the thing. I don't think anybody does. And that's part of the frustration. It's not just the performance of the referees during a match. It's also the fact that we don't know why things aren't improved. I mentioned this to Zach off air yesterday, and I don't know specifically who's responsible for Superliga referees. That may be CONCACAF, but they brought in Howard Webb last year to ref the Superliga final, which is, I guess, a good thing if you think Howard Webb's a good referee, which I'm not sure a lot of people do.
I don't.
But it points to the issue of why was that necessary, Zach?
I mean, it's pretty glaring that if CONCACAF made the decision, and I don't know with Superliga who controls that. I mean,
right.
But let's say CONCACAF did it. Then, it is pretty glaring that you don't have an official in your pool that you feel is worthy enough to handle that match.
Come on, Abby could have done that game with his eyes closed.
Yeah, well, very funny.
thank you.
I don't know. I mean, I don't. It's so fresh. The biggest thing, it's so frustrating with MLS officials because, like Scott said, you'll get one product one week and another product next week, and it just seems like nothing ever changes. I mean, I don't know how many times Abby Okalaja has absolutely destroyed a match in MLS, yet he keeps popping up. It's like he never goes away. According to everything I've seen, MLS officials are assigned by the U.S. Soccer Federation based on performance. So if these guys are the top performers, what else is behind them? If you're not willing to look beyond those guys and see what else is there to give them a shot, you just assume, well, we've got to send whoever our quote-unquote top referees are. And if you're afraid to change it out, then you're going to be stuck with the same thing. I mean, Michael Kennedy is terrible. Thank God, what was his name? Brian Hall, was that one guy's name? I mean, I haven't seen him in a while. Thank God he's gone. I mean, for a while he was considered the top official in United States soccer, and the guy was a joke.
Yeah, but don't forget, I guess, you know, this is something I just thought of while we're talking, is think about where all these other referees, you know, where non-American referees are getting their training. I mean, I'm assuming it works the same, where they're working up from the lower leagues, and they start off in youth, and they work themselves up. Well, that level of competition, by the time they've done it for, you know, 5-10 years, they've been reffing relatively high quality football for many years. These guys are coming up through college, they're coming up through USL1. That level of play, as we start enfolding more international players into our professional league, they really probably haven't had the right amount of time or training to deal with the game at this level. I mean, I look at some of the linesmen, I'm like, how are you a professional linesman? I'm like, I'm kind of shocked by that.
Oh, speaking of linesmen, I'm tired of having USL matches and MLS matches officiated or linesmen who are obese. And I'm not trying to be rude to them. I mean, I'm not exactly Mr. Fit and attractive, but you know, at the same time, I'm not a professional linesman. I don't know how many times. I know, Scott, you've seen it too. I'm sure you've seen it, Jason. Do you guys just get tired of seeing a linesman who has got a gut, who can't keep up with the flow of play, missing offsides calls?
No, it's a definite problem. And even if you're not talking about the ability to perform correctly, the ability to judge, like you said, offsides correctly because they can't keep up with the play, it just doesn't look good. If you're a fan, or if you're somebody who, I'll turn on this MLS match and I'm going to give it a chance, and you look, you know, the camera pans to the sideline, and the linesman has a gut, that's like, what the heck's going on here?
Yeah, nobody wants me to be a linesman. I mean, one, I don't look good in yellow, and two, I just am not fit enough. You need to be the referees, and, you know, they all need to be not as fit as the player, but there certainly has to be some specific requirement, and I'm sure one of them's got to be, you got to look decent in the uniform.
Yes, because that's the most important thing. Forget what they can watch the flow of play, as long as they look good in their referee.
You gotta look good, man.
You mentioned, Scott, the issue with these referees just not having enough experience at a high level of play.
Yeah.
To make the proper decisions when these issues come up. And I think you're right. I mean, experience is everything. The more you see something, the more prepared you are to judge it correctly the next time you see it. That's true in life in general. And sometimes you wonder if these referees are going to an extreme, either one way or the other, a non-call or a red card or whatever it is, because they don't want to be seen as indecisive. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. They want to put their authority on the game. They don't want to be walked over.
Right. They're probably told, you know, I don't know, by MLS or by U.S. Soccer, they're told, you know, make sure you're in control. You don't want these players, you know, especially as MLS has a reputation of being a very physical league, there is a lot of contact in MLS. And because there's so much contact, it's tough when the actual foul is, you know, occurs for these referees to judge what is and what's not and how to let the game flow, because that's what we're talking about here. The game can't flow properly, and therefore the quality suffers because the referees are inconsistent.
Well, you know, we talk so much about how we want our players to go overseas so that they can improve and get better. I mean, we should be demanding the same thing from our referees then, if we feel that our referees are, you know, not. The problem being is that when you send a player over, they have the opportunity to make some serious amounts of money and they can survive and do well. You're sending a referee over and he's making, you know, $5 an hour refereeing some, you know, 10-year-old game. He's getting the experience he wants, but how's he going to live on that? You know, so hopefully there's something that can come in the middle. But I think, to the same point, if, you know, it's different because, you know, you hear of people growing up like in Europe where they're like, well, I really couldn't play as well as I wanted, so I decided I still want to be part of the game, so I was going to go be a referee. That never happens here. That never happens in the state in any of our sports, except maybe I would say that culture is only inherent in one game, and that's probably in Major League Baseball umpires. There's still some sort of feeling of royalty, or there's some sort of mysticism about a Major League Baseball umpire. And maybe it's just me and I'm crazy. But to that point, you know, you can see when you're a kid and you're behind the plate and you're looking all excited. But there's not that with, especially with, you know, being a soccer ref. It's just nowhere to be found. So there's no young pool for us to even be looking at to help improve the play as we get older. I just ranted there.
That's absolutely fine. Zach, you got any last words on the officiating?
Yeah, it's, the bottom line is it's a tough spot. I mean, you can't send, like Scott, you can't send a referee overseas, so to speak. I mean, these are guys that are hired and developed by the individual country's football associations. So we're stuck with what we got. So clearly, the bottom line is I think it needs to be a combined effort between MLS, USL, and the United States Soccer Federation to develop, to hire and train better officials. I mean, it's bottom line. I mean, the amount of effort and time you put into developing your official pool is going to directly affect the results you get from that officials pool. And if you're willing to accept mediocrity and willing to accept poor product from your officials, then that's what you're going
to
get.
As with everything else in this country when it comes to this game, is there was money issues, you know, everywhere. And I'm guessing that U.S. Soccer may not be putting as much money into their refereeing programs as perhaps, you know, is necessary to get the best quality out. But on that note, let's go ahead and take the second break of the show. We'll be right back. More rambling from Scott and more good stuff from Zach. Back with the Match Fit USA Soccer Show. Jason Davis with Zach Woosley and Scott Bornstein. Just a reminder, you can follow MatchFit USA on Twitter, at MatchFit USA. Subscribe to the podcast feed on the site, all that good stuff. Just check out the website for all of that information. Also check out WinningUglyRadio.com and GingTalksOfFooty.com. So let's go ahead and get right into our next topic. The U-17s have qualified for the U-17 World Cup, which I know is like, woohoo,
yay,
exciting deal, right? Were you guys even aware of that?
I did. I was aware of that because you sent it as a topic to us, so I knew that I had to find it out.
Thanks for ruining the spontaneity, so Scott. I appreciate it.
sorry. You can't give. It's like Winning Ugly. It's like the illusion that we're doing it all on the fly.
Theater of the mind, Scott. Theater of the mind. But anyway, okay. So you both were aware that the U-17s qualified. In fact, they won today. They beat Honduras 3-0 today. I think it was today. The bottom line is that, you know, we don't, in this country, we don't pay attention to our youth teams quite as intently as some other countries do. I know in England, you get the U20, U21 European Championship. That's a big, big deal. They play in Wembley, you know, they get a decent crowd. It's all that good stuff. Those are the, you know, the future of the England national team on display. And that may be certain, that may be true for these American kids as well that just qualified. But we really don't know anything about them. And I, you know, I saw some highlights. In fact, you know, let's just go ahead and pull back the curtain. I sent Scott and Zach some links to look at some highlights. Specifically, there's a couple kids who impressed. Do you guys think that this is something that will develop down the road, you know, as Americans become more involved with our national team? I mean, that's kind of blown up recently anyway, but we pay attention to our senior squad. We don't really pay attention to these kids. Let me ask it this way. Scott, do you care?
It's not that I do care, but I think it's, you know, as we speak about it, I think it's a difference in the culture because – really no other sport that we have that, you know, is a mass sport that people follow here, do they have this under 17? You know, our under 20s, what would be our under 20s, is college, and that's what people watch. It's a difference in how the culture of soccer and our, you know, difference between the culture of soccer and the culture of baseball and the culture of right. Football and so, other than like the Little League World Series, but that's 12-year-olds. You know, there's not that understanding that these under 17 teams and these tournaments are very important to the future because in the other sports that people, it's the college game that is that under 17, under 20 league. And it's something that's foreign to most people that there is any importance to a youth development system of this level.
Well, you are talking about in England and other European countries or Brazil or Argentina, you're talking about kids that are already tied to clubs. And the fans of those clubs know these kids are going to be coming through in the next 2 years or 3 years or however long it takes. That's not the case here. None of these kids are with American clubs. So, I mean, do you care as well? What do you think about the whole U whatever teams and how much Americans pay attention to them?
Well, not being tied to clubs is a big part of why people don't necessarily pay attention. Even, you know, big time hardcore fans of MLS teams, oftentimes you won't, I mean, I admit I don't really pay attention to it. And it's not that, like I said, not like Scott, it's not that I don't care. It's just I don't have time on my plate for it to a point. Now, that being said, as an Everton supporter, you know, when some of our kids are playing for the under 20, under 17 teams in England, I'll look and see what's going on because I want to see how they're developing. So there's a tie for me. So if I'm a supporter of an MLS team and I know that we've got a kid in our youth system who's playing on the under 17 men's national team, I'm more likely, I would think, to go and search out that and to see, well, what did he do? Did he start? And if he started, did he score? And whatever it might be. I think it's a learning system. I think as soccer fans grow in the States, you know, you'll come to identify with that more. And especially as the academy system or the idea of a youth system with MLS grows and builds, I think it'll help. Will it ever be paid attention to at the level it is in other countries? I don't know, but Scott's description is correct. I mean, we're so used to the high school, especially with football, with pointy ball, from the high school to college professional. And what people don't realize is that if you really put it in perspective in soccer, then yeah, that's you have your under 17 is sort of your high school team, your under 20, your college team, and then you come to the senior team. It's really not as foreign of an idea as I think a lot of people think it is. Not having club affiliations affects it a lot. And I think you can't identify with the players because you don't know who they are, you don't know where they're going to go, and you don't know if you're ever going to see them play in the league. I mean, if you know potentially you're going to see this kid come in the league in the next year or two, you can get excited about, hey, we got a great young kid who's coming. But when, well, he might be playing for a team in Belgium next year, you know, what do we care? I mean, it's hard enough now when you have quality players on the national team, when you never get to see him. I mean, we never get to see Michael Bradley play.
True.
We never get to see Jose Altidore play that much anymore.
Either does his own team.
But you know what I mean. I mean, it's hard to connect with these kids and to connect with this team when there's nothing to draw us in, so to speak.
Well, I think that the one thing that could possibly change that without the youth systems coming to the forefront, without the academies making a difference for MLS or the American leagues, is if one of these teams actually went out and won something. Not that it would be it's not the biggest deal in the world if the U-17s go and win the U-17 World Cup. But as because American soccer fans, we don't have any of those trophies to crow about. If they did go and win that title, that would probably be a fairly big deal. And I think more people who are already invested in, say, the senior team would start paying attention more to the kids as they come up.
Well, I think of all the buzz that the under-20s got during the last round. I mean, that was huge, and it brought people like Altidore, and it brought, you know, Freddie Adu. I think you're right. I think if we're doing well in the tournament and someone starts mentioning it, then it becomes important. It's kind of like the typical American, fan base. You know, hey, oh, my God, we're doing something good? Okay, let's watch. And that's basically the entire reason that women's professional soccer does anything at this point is because they're good at it, so people
That's
watch
true.
It.
Any other thoughts, Zach?
Yeah, I was actually taking a second to look at the under 17 roster, and you can see the club affiliation the kids have, and a lot of them are teams that I've never heard of because they're local regional squads like West Pines United FC and Rampage FC, and I'm sure in like youth soccer, if you're an ardent follower of youth soccer, that some of these clubs probably you'll know about. But from a perspective of someone who follows the professional game, I don't know who these are. But there is one kid who's from the New York Red Bulls Academy. So that's a good sign. If I can look at this roster and see New York Red Bull Academy or FC Dallas Youth or Vancouver, the Whitecaps system, then I can start to connect and say, well, there's this kid, Juan, I'm probably going to butcher his name, Juan Aguildo, who's a forward for the under 17. He's in the New York Red Bull system. So I can say, well, look, this kid Juan, he's winning Red Bulls, and maybe in a couple of years I'll see him, and I'll say, hey, I remember him. He was on the U.S. men's national team, the under 17 team that went to the under 17 World Cup. You know, those connections we've got to start to build, and it'll be a heck of a lot easier when we understand the club affiliations. And the system is so disjointed right now, and I'm not criticizing it. It's just the way it's always been. And I think MLS is trying now to try to force itself into that really well-established youth soccer structure, but I think it's a push that has to be made, and I think it'll be beneficial in the long term.
Right, and I think that both U.S. soccer and MLS are making their efforts to improve the system as fast as they possibly can while still looking out at the bottom line because they have to worry about money. Just like I mentioned, every aspect of the game in this country, it's tied back to money because there's only so much to go around. Now, just for fun, pure speculation, How long do you think it will take, I'll start with you, Scott, for the U-17 or the U-20 teams, when you look at the roster, every single one of those kids is tied to a professional club in the United States?
You figure it's going to take, for that age frame, probably 4 generations. So you're looking at 10 to 12 years before that's actually even a possibility. Only because, and it even now that I'm thinking about it, maybe even longer than that, because how many MLS teams actually even have their youth development system? I mean, I know Dallas does, but who else at this point? I think Chivas USA does only because Chivas inherently builds their youth system, but I don't know who else. So it could be longer than that. Could be, almost be 20 years.
Well, Houston has a youth development system. Seattle has a youth development system. New York does. FC Dallas does. And I think there's other clubs that do. So I think there's more there than we realize.
They're just not producing anything.
They're not producing yet. But I think the time frame's hard to guess at, because I think what really is going to affect this time frame is how quickly kids and parents see results from players that enter these programs.
Exactly.
If you can go into a youth market, let's say, I live in Dallas, we'll use that as perspective. If FC Dallas can go into the youth system here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and go to these kids and the parents and say, look, we brought in these players. Within a certain amount of time, they were playing in MLS, or they had gotten contracts overseas, or whatever it is that works out. You know, if you can show those results, you're going to show those academy systems are going to buoy real quick.
Well, I mean, I think we even talked about this on the show probably a couple of weeks ago, where part of the youth problem was that they had players who were told, hey, you have to dedicate your time to the youth program here with this team. And they were upset because they couldn't go play for their high school teams anymore. So they quit the youth development. I mean, what does that say about our youth development programs at this point, where it's more important for them to go play their high school football than to come and play on a professional youth development team? So
those are kids the league doesn't need, because those are kids that aren't dedicated to the sport. I know that sounds a little harsh.
That's not necessarily true. It's a function of the system, because you're talking about a league that still gets the majority of their talent from the college draft. And those kids know if they don't play in high school, they don't go to college, they don't get drafted.
So they need to change the system, because
that's exactly the point. If they don't change the system, those kids are going to continue to take that path instead of going into an academy and eventually making their debut at 18 or 19 for the first team of FC Dallas or whoever it is.
Well, if you're in the youth academy, hopefully it's been explained to you that if you are in this youth academy, the goal is for you to come play on the senior team. I would think they would have known that.
No results to point to.
You
could point to college kids going and playing for Wake Forest and getting drafted, and if they get a Generation Adidas contract, they make a decent amount of money. You can't point to that in the academy system right now. Those kids get moved up, and they're on developmental contracts, and they make $15,000 a year.
Very true.
Yeah. Well, it's going to take time, and the thing the league needs to look at, too, as far as changing the system, is that you're giving these Generation Adidas kids a truckload of money compared to other players. I mean, there's kids that are 17, 18 years old that are making over $100,000 a year. And that's ridiculous, because I don't have the numbers in front of me, and I may be wrong, but I'm pretty convinced, based on I've seen, that the averages are not good for these kids for fail versus success. And I think the numbers are heavily tilted toward the fail side of careers in MLS. And if for these academy system to really work, you're going to have to make it worthwhile for not only the kids coming out, for all players. I mean, they've got to do something about players making – you have a player making $20,000 a year who maybe starts even, versus a kid that's making $100,000 a year and doesn't even play. The system's out of whack, but I'm not upset about it, because it's new. And it's something that's going to take time to work the kinks out of. So I think at this point it's kind of we have to support it and be positive about it and hope that they'll go in the right direction with it. But we can't expect instantaneous results, because it's not going to happen. There's just too much of a system that's already built.
That's absolutely true. But I wonder sometimes. I mean, you think about, like I mentioned, the draft. You think about how much these MLS teams are relying on the draft. And they should, because that's the system that's in place. But until you take that safety net away and make them go out and find their own talent. I mean, I know there's regional issues and which teams can get kids from which areas, and there's all those concerns, and I understand those concerns. But until you make these MLS teams go and find their next generation of talent, they're not going to. They're gonna continue to rely on things like the super draft and going out and signing foreign players instead of American kids.
Yeah, but part of the reason that they didn't do it before was because they couldn't even – the people that they would bring up through whatever development programs they had, they weren't even allowed to keep. they had to put him into the draft. At least the difference
being... That's a ridiculous rule. That
has changed now. That was part of the reason when the development youth came in, because that's also part of the problem, is that you spend this time and you spend this energy on bringing these kids in, and then you don't even get to keep them.
Yeah, and they get to keep one kid a year, which still doesn't really fix the problem.
No, but it's a start.
Well, I guess you could look at it that way. I mean, and like I said, you know, we started off the show giving Garber credit for getting it in a marketing situation or a marketing standpoint. But you also have to wonder, and it's not all Garber's doing, obviously. I mean, the league is run by the Board of Governors, all these owners getting together. And they all put these checks and balances in place to make sure that NASL doesn't happen again. You know, I think from a casual fan standpoint, sometimes it's easy to think that it's overkill and that they're actually doing more harm than good. But if you put it in the proper perspective, you could obviously defend every one of these little quirks of the rules. It as a fan, as somebody who wants to see the league get better and doesn't want to have to wait 20 years for it to happen, you wonder why some of these things aren't changed now.
Yeah, I'm sure there's things behind the scenes that we either don't know about or aren't aware of that affect why it isn't a change now. I think right now the league is dominated and controlled by the bottom line and the of the financial ledgers. And until, you know, the economy hasn't helped, but until all the thinking of the league owners isn't centered around money, which I think a lot of it is right now, it's going to be hard to make a lot of the changes that need to be made. Because right now it's all about trying to get break even, trying to get in the black. And that's why you have situations where front offices and team ownerships are more concerned with how they can use their new stadiums to make money versus how they can improve their team. You're not going to get a commitment to those academy systems and a commitment to the youth systems until teams are profitable and owners aren't hemorrhaging money.
It's a luxury they can't afford at the moment.
Yeah, it's a luxury. Exactly. It's exactly right. It's a luxury, and it's not one that most teams can afford. And until the league properly rewards and allows teams to hold on to players that they develop, and I think the big part of that is they're going to have to change the roster system. You got to have – not necessarily active roster, but you got to give these teams bigger rosters. Getting rid of the reserve system I never really read a lot about it, and it seems such a dumb idea, because I know you have to pay players, and I know it's tough, and I know money's tight right now, but
that's all about travel expenses and things like that.
Yeah, but
that's what that's about. It's the reserve league, so you have your roster of 25, you dress your 18, and you know, whatever kids you want to go play, you know, Dallas and Chicago are getting together to play in MLS. You take your reserve squad with you. And the day before the game, you play a reserve match. And they're not doing that now.
Right. And I understand the money side of things. It's just, I don't want to get into another topic, but just real quickly, I mean, it's going to affect this. The change in the roster system is going to affect MLS as far as their performance in the other tournaments and Open Cups and CONCACAF Champions League, because there's just not enough players. I mean, yeah. 25 guys is not enough to survive three tournaments, to survive a league schedule and two or three tournaments. I mean, you're just killing these teams. I mean, you've got to have a pool of players to call on.
Well, and you combine that two or three teams with now World Cup qualifying. Now you're even taxing those guys more.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not fair. You have 25 guys to call on, and then your three or four best players get called by the national team. And what are you supposed to do? I mean, all of a sudden now you're short. You don't
not
have
play, not players. Play on international dates.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, we could go over that.
But no, we're not, and I'm going to stop you right there. Let's go ahead. We started off talking about U-17s, and we tangented, whatever that, I'm making up words over here. Started talking about the U-17s, we went off on a tangent. I think it's all good stuff. Let's go ahead and take a break, come back with Zach, and we've got one more segment of the MatchFit USA Soccer Show. Back to close out MatchFit USA Soccer Show with Zach, Scott, and Jason. Thank you very much for listening. We're just going to go ahead and talk about one little quick thing. The World Cup bid, the United States is looking at trying to get either the 2018 or the 2022 World Cup. I said that right, 2022?
Yes.
There's a couple different things that happened in the past, you know, week and a half or so. First, President Obama sends a letter to FIFA. Does that make a difference in your mind, Scott?
Of course. He's the superstar right now.
Well, I mean, are you being sarcastic?
No, I'm being complete. I mean, this man, I think having him wanting to do, you know, take care of the bid and talking about how he played the game as a youth, and that's a big deal. And, you know, there is one other aspect of it, which is probably no one's going to have more money to throw at this thing than we will, whether we're in a recession or not.
That's a different issue.
But
we'll get to that in a second.
Sorry. I think his letter helps.
About the Obama effect. And Zach, do you think it's a pleat in the cape for the U.S. bid and it'll actually make a difference, or is it just kind of like, well, of course he's going to do that, and it really won't decide it either way?
I don't think necessarily we'll decide it either way, but I think it's a good thing, because any country that's trying to get their World Cup on board, if the highest person in power in the land is on board, then that's a good thing. I mean, that shows FIFA that the country's behind the movement to get it there, and they're taking it seriously. And it's just kind of a good little pat on the back to say, we want it, you know, we're taking this seriously, and then, you know, you go from there. I mean, the U.S. soccer will still have to do the work they need to do, but I think it's a positive thing having him supporting it.
Not only that, I mean, we had, what, 58 cities come forward and say, we want to host? I mean,
well,
that's huge.
That's another thing I want to get into. Sorry. Well, yeah, that's my point about the stadiums. They had a list of 70 that came out originally from U.S. soccer. They sent out, you know, I'm assuming 70 form letters saying, hi, we like your stadium. Would you like to host the World Cup? And 58 of them respond. Now, I'm wondering about those 12 and how stupid those people are. But 58 of them responded, yes, we would like to host a World Cup soccer match. Now, I'm a little cynical about that situation. I think that, like Zach just said, it's all a money grab. Those cities, most of them, the people running the situation with the stadiums, they don't care about soccer. They don't care that it's a World Cup. They hear World Cup and they go, ooh, cash. Now, the bottom line is that U.S. soccer put the list together to show FIFA, look at all these stadiums we've got. We've got 70,000 plus stadiums in the United States. There's not another country in the world that can match that. Is it a big deal that 58 said yes, please, Zach?
No, it's not. I mean, there's a lot of cities in there where you can, you know, these stadiums get the letter and they say, yeah, we're willing to do it. We can think of the money. But that's the biggest thing and the reason that I'm not shocked that the World Cup doesn't come to the U.S. more. And I think moving into the future beyond where our fandom goes, that I think you'll see the U.S. getting a regular U.S. Cup hosting duties, because, like you said, there's no other country that can match our stadium infrastructure. You hear about other countries like South Africa with the next World Cup. They're having to build stadiums. They're having to plunge a lot of money into setting up the system. You don't have to do that here. I mean, you can theoretically, you can put on a World Cup rather cheaply in the United States. And there's still a lot to do, but
which means the profit is a lot bigger.
Yeah, your profit line has to be a lot better with the stadiums already here. I mean, there's no question. And at the rate we replace stadiums, I mean, there's constantly going to be a pool of good stadiums to use for major international tournaments here. And you know, but with anything, with the Final Four, with Super Bowl, it's all about money. And stadiums and owners and cities are going to get involved because they see it as a way to make some money. And that's the American way. I don't like it, but that's the way it's always going to be when it comes to a World Cup. And so it's kind of, I view we have to just accept it.
Scott?
Listen, the state of Texas alone has enough stadiums that could host the World Cup, and it's bigger than some of the countries who want to do it.
It's very true.
I'll talk about what the downside is for America, is that it's so vast and it's so grand, it's where do you put it? Where do you put all the different games? Because the travel becomes, you know, a big deal. If your team's made it to the final and you're playing in Miami and now all of a sudden you got to get to L.A. to go watch your team, That's a hike. That's a lot of money. I think that's the only downside. But on the opposite end of that, our infrastructure is so good. You know, Zach was talking about South Africa having to build stadiums. They don't have to just build stadiums. They don't have roads. They don't even have the roads to the stadiums. If you wanted to, I think the biggest selling point here is to, again, to Zach's point, if you told us tomorrow that we need to move the World Cup and play it here, we're ready.
Right. We just need to build some trains. We get trains, we're in good shape. High-speed trains across the country were the ultimate World Cup destination.
Oh, that could be part of the Obama
And there's where Obama
plan.
Comes in.
That's where he steps
high
in.
High-speed trains.
And he'll even say, idea. Not only that, right, I'll build you high-speed trains.
High-speed trains, I got it. Let's go ahead and close out on this. Just to wrap up the World Cup discussion.
I don't want to go.
I'm sorry, Scott.
Okay.
But I do have a question for you.
Yes.
Is a World Cup in the United States, either 2018 or 2022, a foregone conclusion?
No, not at all. I don't think so at all.
No, I don't think it is either. I think there's a lot of positives, and I think there's a lot of good things that FIFA can see about the United States. But I think, Jason, you brought up a good point. I think the travel and the size of the country is a major issue. Or Scott.
Just want to give Scott credit. He did bring up that point.
Okay. Well, that's the bottom line. I think that's a big
Then quickly before we go, if it's not a foregone conclusion, what are the percentages for either one? Scott, just a guess.
I'm guessing we probably have a 50% chance of getting it. I look at a country like with an emerging economy, like India, if they go after it, they have just as much ability to pull that off as we do.
Yeah, but I think you're going to see world politics and issues affect those decisions.
True.
Because if you have cricket matches getting terrorist attacks like have happened in that region, it's going to make FIFA a little afraid to go there.
But
I mean,
security is part of the issue now. And
yeah.
There's maybe, you know, maybe England can handle it, but the United States and Germany, and you know, they just got done with their World Cup. The United States could handle the security. That's
yeah,
true.
I think as much as FIFA wants to spread the game around and reward different parts of the planet with the World Cup, I think that they're going to be forced in a way to give the United States a World Cup in 2018 or 2022. I would say by 2022, if we don't get one of those bids, I'd be shocked. I'd put it as high as 80 or 90% that we'll get one of those.
I mean, they've definitely learned some lessons with granting it to South Africa. I mean, up until maybe 6 months ago, they still didn't even know if they could have it there.
Absolutely. And I'm not even sure that they're completely convinced it's coming off yet. So
no, there's still a lot of issues.
Let's go ahead and close out. We talked too much, all three of us, probably me the most. But I want to thank Scott and Zach from Winning Ugly Radio. Zach from Genstock for joining me on the Match at USA Soccer Show. Thank you very much to Scott for making this happen. And Zach as well.
It's been my pleasure.
I wouldn't be back yet. I appreciate you guys helping me out.
No problem.
Until next week, Match Fit USA Soccer Show, Jason Davis signing off.